Good morning, diners and travelers and revelers. And here we are with one of our special boozy programs again.
After all, we did last week, we talked about food for the holidays.
What's
food without drink if you're celebrating? So ready for you to celebrate the new year, for which, incidentally, we at On the Menu wish you a very happy one and a very prosperous
2014.
One. 2014. Wow, isn't it scary? Scary how fast the years go by.
That we started the show in 2004.
Yeah.
In January.
Exactly. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So it's,
I guess
we're in our 11th year.
Right.
We're celebrating our 10th anniversary. We're in our 11th year. What a surprise. And in this program, not only are we talking beverages, but we're talking to people who in their own special way are pioneers. And we'll introduce them by why they're pioneers in just a little bit. Our first guest, Joe Magliocco. I got it wrong. Has been on the program before, talking about mostly about another aspect of his business. But one of the things that fascinated us is the way that he has revived an all-American liquor company, which actually went out of business in the 1980s.
Well, he goes Joe Magliocco. gives a really great interview. So let's just listen to Joe.
Joe Magliocco, you should be making limoncello or grappa. but instead of doing that, it appears that you've single-handedly decided to transform the American whiskey production and market all at the same time. Welcome again to our show. We're delighted that you were able to join us today. And I understand that you're from the heart of bourbon country today.
Yes, I'm speaking to you from the Shively section of Louisville. The Shively section actually has been home to like a lot of the great distilleries. It was home to a lot of the old Seagram's Kentucky plants and some of the National Distillers buildings, and has a tremendous amount of whiskey history in this part of Louisville. But Louisville itself is just a beautiful city. But I thank you so much to you and to Ann for having me on. I'm such a big fan of your show.
Yeah, well, we love you, Joe, as you know.
Well, now hold on a second.
You.
The interesting thing is that you helped to rebuild some of this history, because where you're speaking to us from is a new place.
Yes, it is a quite new place. We received our DSP, our Distilled Spirits Plant licensing, we received in 2012. And fortunately, we restarted Michter's. I was actually working with a gentleman, Dick Newman, who had been president of Boston Nichols, a maker of Wild Turkey. And what we call brown goods, American whiskey business was in a virtual depression in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s. And unfortunately, the tough market claimed Michter's in Pennsylvania, which went bankrupt in 89. And in the mid-90s, Dick Newman, former president of Wild Turkey, and I decided to bring back the Michter's again. And we set up shop in Kentucky, which just has just such tremendous whiskey resources. And fortunately, things have gone well.
Now, hold on, but Michter's was actually made in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Correct. Michter's was founded in 1753 in Schaeferstown, Pennsylvania, and actually it was made in Pennsylvania until 1989.
Now
when the Pennsylvania Company went bankrupt.
Now you like breaking rules. We've already referred to the fact that you decided that you didn't want to buy just any old distillery. You'd actually build your own, and that came online, I think you said, in 2012?
Yeah, we've gone through different phases. Initially, when Dick and I started, Kentucky in the 90s was awash with whiskey. The market was quite different than it is right now. And people were sitting with just incredible quality older whiskeys. They were just so happy to offload to somebody. And so we bought some pretty wonderful stocks that obviously having led Wild Turkey, Dick knew his way around Kentucky pretty well, and we bought some wonderful stocks that were the style that we were going to start making ourselves. And unfortunately, it's worked.
Now, you're not quite finished yet, though, because you were explaining to me before we came on the air that there's a difference between a pot still and a column still, and presumably column stills are more complex because you're having one custom made for you and it's not quite finished yet.
No, you're absolutely right. Right now at our Shively facility in Louisville, we have two pot stills right now. And to increase our capacity substantially, we're putting in a continuous still. It's another word for column still. And basically, it's sort of like a long tower. We like copper, so our column still is going to be 100% copper, 15 sift trays, three bubble trays, and we're going to also have a second copper pot still. So everything that we do will be finished on a copper pot still, but it will initially come off the column still. And, you know, column stills have, both types of stills have their advantages, and people can wax much more eloquently about me about the various advantages. Column stills have probably better consistency than pot stills, but pot stills do wonderful stuff too, and so we're going to have the best of both worlds with a column still and a pot still. And it's interesting because distillation really is both a science, but also on an art. And I think one of the very best still makers in the world is Vendome in Louisville. And it's interesting because Vendome in Louisville actually made the Pennsylvania column still for the old Michters in Pennsylvania. And as we've studied and custom designed this still, we've looked at the old diagrams, and you know, Vendome just does remarkable work.
Yeah, there's so much history here. We just went through the celebration of the repeal.
Prohibition.
Prohibition.
We just celebrated.
Yes, absolutely.
We just celebrated the 21st Amendment.
Yeah, it's
yes. Yeah, exactly.
It's big time in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's true, and it's really interesting that Michter should go out of business after Prohibition was repealed.
I know.
It's an interesting story there. But listeners, I want you to understand this distillation thing just a little bit, and I think I probably explain it in words that you'll find easier to understand than Joe, because Joe's an expert and his staff is an expert. What you do is you put the stuff that you're going to make up your mixture at the bottom of this thing, whether it's a column or a pot, and you stew it up like crazy until it all vaporizes. And then guess what? You capture the gas and you cool it down so it becomes liquid again.
That's a great description, because obviously the boiling point of the alcohol is lower than the boiling point of the water, and in effect, you basically make and cook a soup of your grain selection, your water, and your yeast. And it's exactly as Peter said.
Now, you're doing something else that's different, although you revived the traditional Michter's brands, which were, now, did they make one called a bourbon? Because if not, you now do that.
The Michter's distillery in Pennsylvania had a lot of different products. They had bourbon, they had rye, and they were quite famous. Their most famous type in the 1970s and the 1980s was Michter's Sour Mash.
You make that now, because we have a bottle.
Yeah, we drank that too.
Yeah.
Great.
But the one that's interesting is the one you call the unblended American whiskey. Now, explain those words American and unblended to our audience, because they probably never had an unblended American whiskey before.
It's an interesting product, and it has a very different flavor profile because of the leeway we have in making American whiskey versus making bourbon and rye. The United States has extraordinarily tough standards for the production of bourbon and the production of American rye whiskey. Both bourbon and American rye whiskey, you must have a very specific mash bill. The mash bill is basically your percentages of grain ingredients that we use. You must use 51% or more corn as your grain for bourbon by law. You must use 51% or more rye grain as your grain in an American rye whiskey. And another thing you must do by statutory definition in the United States is both bourbon and rye have to be aged in a brand new charred white oak barrel that's never been used before.
Got it.
When we make American whiskey, it's an interesting thing because our master distiller, Willie Pratt, gets to be more creative in his grain selection. It doesn't have to be 51% corn like a bourbon. It doesn't have to be 51% rye like a rye. So Willie can be more creative with his mash bill. It doesn't have to be 51% this or 51% that. The other thing that's different about it is that we're actually able to age American whiskey in what we call used cooperage. That is barrels that have previously stored bourbon in our case. So because we're not calling it a bourbon, we're allowed to use barrels that have already been soaked and already sort of cured with our other Michter's bourbon, and the flavor profile comes out quite a bit different. Now, the unblended part of it is yet another thing. If you take a look at most American whiskeys on the marketplace, if you look carefully at the label, the fine print, the front, the back, up the side, you will see that it says that a certain percentage of it, usually two-thirds or more, a certain percentage of it is grain-neutral spirits or vodka. You can add that to American whiskey, but we're allowed to call our American whiskey unblended because it is all whiskey. We don't blend in any grain-neutral spirits.
Now, is there a secret to what's in your mash bill?
We don't release the mash bill. Will fire me or worse.
So there really is a secret. Now, interestingly enough, listeners,
absolutely.
Listeners will be interested in the fact that, curiously enough, Scotch whiskey is generally aged, is almost always aged in barrels that have been used for something else, including a very large number of sherry. Bourbon barrels, or bourbon barrels especially, because bourbon barrels, guess what? They're highly available because the people who make bourbon have to do something with them after a year. They either break them up or they sell them off.
Exactly.
So now we've already talked about Willie Pratt, who's the master distiller, but you just added some horsepower to your distilling crew.
Yes. Yeah, no, Willie and I, with these new stills that we're putting in and expanding our operations the way that we are, we really wanted to get a strong distiller to also work under Willie with him, and because we just have so many different things going on right now, and we just feel so lucky. We hired a woman, Pamela Heilman. Pamela Heilman ran the distillery, the Booker No Distillery, for Jim Beam. She was there for 7.5 years running it. She was 15 years at Beam, which is a great company. And there aren't too many people that could say that they ran the biggest bourbon distillery in the world, but Pamela can. And she had 23 direct reports at the distillery, and she's quite experienced and really just makes terrific whiskey. She's fantastic.
She sounds like a Wonder Woman. Yeah, now, press release we got.
Why did she decide to change? I mean, she was already running the biggest bourbon distillery. He said, I mean, was there something that an opportunity?
I guess she wanted to go to the smallest.
Okay, there you go.
In all seriousness, yeah, we're doing some really interesting things here now in Louisville, and I think she really, again, Beam is just a fantastic company. I can't say why she left her or didn't leave, but we just feel really, really, really lucky to have her. And I know that she's very excited about the way that we're making our whiskey and what we're doing. We do a whole bunch of different things that, that some other companies don't do. You know, we have the luxury of being a small producer. We have the luxury of being a privately owned company. And basically, our ownership says, don't worry about what your cost of goods sold is. If you know how to make the whiskey better, and if it's more expensive to do it that way, just do it. Right now, we're aging Michters in barrels where the wood is air-dried before it's ever made into a barrel. Some of the barrels that we're using right now, the wood has been air-dried for 36 months. That's 3 years before it's even made into a barrel. You have to char your barrels for bourbon and for rye. But in addition, before we do that, we toast the barrels. And when you toast the barrels first, it's more expensive to do so, but you concentrate the sugars in the wood. And so the whiskey will age richer and sweeter. One of the other things that Willie does that's quite expensive is Willie barrels at 103 proof rather than 125 proof, which is the industry standard. The barrels cost more than the white dog that you put into it. So obviously, if you can concentrate the alcohol more, use less barrels, that's much less expensive, but the whiskey won't come out as good. So we're doing all sorts of steps, and even the old Pennsylvania company, their motto was cost be damned, and we're keeping up that tradition.
Now tell me this, taste really drastically changing, because so many of these small specialized distilleries are popping up and everywhere from Pittsburgh to Brooklyn.
Absolutely. I think that I'm not sure that tastes are changing as much as just that it's almost like when the financial people talk about reversion to the mean. 20, 30 years ago, there were tons of sort of small whiskey brands that were around, and you can go into a store and then the whiskey category shrunk tremendously. And now, like I said, it seems to be a bit of a reversion to the mean. You know, things seem to be coming back to where they were, and, and the generation of 25 plus to and older, they seem to really be embracing bourbon and embracing rye tremendously.
Now, I wanted to, how can I put this? I know Ann, I'm surprised Ann didn't ask this question, but the there can't be a lot of lady distillers out there. Can we expect that there will be an interesting...
Well, look at what's happened to winemakers. There are tons of winemakers that are women.
But not many distillers, I'll bet. So I'm wondering if down the road there won't be a sort of a more delicate kind of whiskey, just because the ladies have more delicate palates.
That it's an interesting question. I can tell you that we're not planning to change our style. Our style is rich and flavorful and smooth, and we, you know, we're going to continue to pursue that. And when you take a look at some of the stuff that Pam and the Bean people were making, I mean, just tremendous. I mean, Basil Hayden, beautiful stuff. Knob Creek, great stuff. Booker's, Baker's. I mean, they made some tremendous, tremendous stuff. But I would assume, I honestly am not that familiar with many women distillers, to be honest. But Pam's stuff is just quite wonderful. And I would assume, like anything else, I would assume, like, every other field, that you're going to see just some wonderfully successful people from all different types of backgrounds, be incredibly successful, in the spirit business.
Now, you were going to tell us about the special celebration release.
Yeah, we're really proud of that. I can't say how proud Willie and team and I are of that one. For years, cognacs and scotches have been issuing rare releases successfully for thousands of dollars a bottle. And we're so proud that Michter's Celebration Sour Mash is the first American whiskey that's sold successfully and been successfully received at this price range. The suggested retail price is $4,000 a bottle. You'll typically see it in different markets. Typically, we're seeing it basically from $3,500 to $4,000 a bottle on a shot, an ounce shot in a restaurant or a bar, usually around like $300 to $400. But it's really special whiskey. Basically, Willie went through our stocks, and Willie, obviously we taste our barrels regularly, and when they get older, we taste them even more frequently, because we have to watch them. You don't want them to get too woody. And if they're starting to get woody, you gotta bottle them fast. But there are some barrels that we taste and we just love. And Willie and I were saying, you know what? We should put together a mix from our very favorite barrels in the distillery. So basically, Willie put together a blend, a Michter's Celebration Sour Mash, from picking a little bit from this barrel and a little bit from that barrel, his very favorite barrels in the distillery. And some of the barrels are over 30 years old, and the whiskey's magnificent.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really...
Well, we haven't
really
had any of that, Joe.
No.
I'll have to arrange that.
I'll
have to arrange that.
We'll be waiting at the door when Mr. FedEx comes to bring that one.
The great thing is please.
Go ahead.
No.
I shouldn't say, but this year we released 200 souls. And we're getting all these calls from accounts and people that want, but we're out at this point,
some of the people? Do you have any profile of these customers that do this? I've often wondered.
I'm not going to identify individuals, but one of the best stores in the country, it's a fine wine store, and they have tremendous Hollywood clientele, is Wally's in Los Angeles. And Wally's, Christian Navarro, the co-owner there, was telling me that he has all sorts of celebrities that have bought bottles and looking for bottles. But we have some wonderful places around the country. I mean, I know, like, some of the on-premise places, Montage Resort in Laguna Beach, the Aviary, which is an amazing mixology place in Chicago. The Aviary is amazing. Little Nell Hotel in Aspen.
Oh, yeah, right.
Cafe Ballou, Restaurant Danielle's Cafe Ballou in New York. I mean, just wonderful, so really some of the top places in the country have sort of brought her on the pre-sale and sort of locked it up.
Well, this is a wonderful success story so far, and it sounds like there's going to be even more success to come in the future. So we'll be watching developments at Michter's, and listeners, you should be doing the same thing and enjoying as we have been doing. And Joe Malioko.
I've been tutoring him on this
quite perfect pronunciation.
Yeah, perhaps we should be fortunate that you're not making grappa and nocello and what's the other one?
Limoncello.
We're glad you're in Louisville. We're glad that the business of Mictas is arriving well again, thanks to you and your partners. And thank you so much for joining us today. And looking at my clock, let's see, I'm going to open a new bottle of Mictas around 120 minutes from now, and I'll raise a glass to you, Joe, and you'll be able to see me doing it.
Like I said, I'm such a big fan of On the Menu, and just I'm thrilled to be on, so thank you so much.
Okay,
thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We just wanted you to know that On the Menu started a memorial fund where you can contribute so that we can buy a bottle of the $4,000 whiskey.
we could do a Kickstarter.
But seriously, folks, we'll be right back after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and why don't you introduce this next here?
One of the most fascinating stories about wine in these United States is the development of the wine-making business, or the making of wine altogether, in the state of Oregon, which many people thought for many years was totally unsuitable for wine. It turns out it's not. It's an absolutely marvelous place to grow grapes and to make a wonderful Pinot Noir.
They're happy that the grapes.
And the Willamette Valley Vineyards was one of the operations which started in the very early days, in the early 1970s. And we had the opportunity to catch up with someone who's continuing tradition. It turns out that the owner, Don Crank, the winemaker, Don Crank, was standing in for the owner of the property, who unfortunately was ill. But he tells a fascinating story about why Oregon's successful, what it takes to make an Oregon Pinot Noir successful, and what he thinks is right and wrong about the way you should go about making wine. So it's a really interesting interview. The bad news is we're missing a winemaker today, Jim Bernau from Willamette Valley Vineyards, but we've got an able replacement in the form of Don Crank, who is the winemaker, and the vineyard was kind enough to send us some of their wonderful Pinot Noirs to sample, which we did, and now we're going to talk real time to the person who was actually responsible. Welcome to On the Menu, Don.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, where are you speaking to us from today?
So I'm speaking to you from my office in the winery, Willamette Valley Vineyards Estate Winery, just the town of Turner, Oregon, just south of Salem, the middle of the Willamette Valley wine-growing region.
Apologize for my ignorance, but we've tended to travel to the Oregon wine country coming from Portland, and as a result, seeing the wine-growing area as being really quite northerly in the state of Oregon. But you're quite a long way to the south, perhaps not quite as far as south as the King Estate. And so
right.
So it appears that there's good wine growing all the way down the Willamette Valley?
Well, you know, that's right. There is. And some of our best vineyards in the Willamette Valley may lie unexplored along that kind of southern part of the valley. The biggest concentration of vineyards is in Yamhill County, just sort of west, southwest of Portland, and we're about an hour directly south. So we're all the sub-AVAs, too, are located north of Salem. So the AVAs run out as you get down the valley to where we are. And there's quite a bit of viticulture in the Mid and South Valley, but not quite as many wineries because they seem to be grouped around the towns of Carlton and Dundee and where all those AVAs are.
So, Newburgh and places like that.
I think there's a lot of quality vineyards and also a lot of potential for the South Valley in the mid. Two of our vineyards are actually in that northern portion, and only one of our vineyards here is just south of Salem.
But that was the first one.
That's right. Jim Bruno planted the winery in 1983 to the Pomard clone and Vadensville clone. We also planted some Riesling that was then top worked over later on with our new Dijon clones that he and the governor of Oregon at the time, Neil Goldschmidt, and David Adelsheim, and a lot of other luminaries of the industry, brought back these new Dijon clones, and they are now planted in that vineyard as well as actually all of our vineyard properties now have those clones.
But Jim was a bit of a rebel, really, growing where he started to grow, I guess.
That's right. You'll see that a lot of times. Back, if you go back to 1983, it was not agreed upon exactly where the best place in Oregon to grow grapes were, and so people tried different elevations and different types of soils and things like that. And so, you know, he found a good patch of Jory soil out here south of Salem, which is the same soil type that's in the Eola Amity wine growing region, as well as the Red Hills of Dundee also have this Jory soil. And it's essentially, this vineyard is a continuation of that spine of the Eola Amity Hills. That was kind of washed away by the Willamette River in between us and those hills.
Now, this was a post-glacial deposit, right?
That's right.
If I'm thinking of it correctly, resulting from the melting of the Great Ice Age glaciers in those mountains.
Yes, that's right. That's what that's the soil type in the valley floor. But most of our vineyards, almost any successful vineyard in the Willamette Valley, will not be grown on those kind of very deep and very fertile soils. We actually grow on the hills above those deposits of silt from the glacial age, on essentially what is a much older type of soil that is volcanic in nature.
It's
called Jory soil, and it's really, really highly weathered and decayed basalt from the time of the Ring of Fire. When a lot of volcanic activity happened in the Pacific Northwest. And these soils are pretty poor for any other type of agriculture. There are failed prune orchards and cherry orchards on these soils before they started to be planted to grapes. But the soil is very good to make the vines struggle a bit, and we get smaller berries, which means we make more intense red wines.
Now, your background as a winemaker, are you an Oregon native, or did you move from California, or where?
Well, no, it's funny you ask. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. There aren't many of us out here from Memphis making wine, but I kind of caught the bug in Europe visiting Burgundy, and my father graciously let us try some very nice European wines, and California wines, actually, at his table. And, as long as I can remember, I thought it would be fun to be a winemaker, although I took a strange biochemistry sort of detour in there, but then came back around to food science and wine pretty quickly.
Now, have you read this book about this madman called Ray Walker?
No, I haven't.
He decided that, even though he really didn't know very much about wine, he decided that he wanted to grow grapes and make wine in Burgundy.
Oh, wow. That sounds hard.
And this is the story of how he did it. We actually interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and it's just like, Ray, you must be totally crazy. but he did it anyway.
Well, you hear of winemakers that take some time and learn French and spend some time in Burgundy, one or two harvests and that sort of thing, and come back full of ideas and that sort of thing. But to actually purchase property or even purchase grapes and make a go of making wine in Burgundy under your own steam is
pretty amazing.
It's kind of an amazing story. I think I'll have to pick that book up.
Almost as crazy as starting to grow grapes in Oregon. Everybody knew.
That's right.
Everybody knew you couldn't
remember
do that.
In the mid-60s, everybody thought it was too wet and cold to grow grapes in Oregon. And a small group of people that was looking closely at some climatological data as students at maybe America's premier wine university, certainly at that time, UC Davis, and they just thought that they were enamored of Pinot Noir and enamored of Burgundy, and thought, why not? And yeah, I think they were called crazy a bit until all of the success happened in the 80s and until today.
Right, the doctor who founded Elk Cove, I think his son reported that Mrs. McDonald, I think it is, once asked her husband, now, exactly how many Oregon Pinot Noirs have you drunk? And he couldn't remember that he ever had, but he just decided to grow wine anyway.
Ah, that's great.
Now, talk to us about the 2010 vintage. I was just reading the tasting notes, and it sounds like you must have had your fingers crossed for this particular year, because you left things on the vine for a very long time.
Well, that's right. There's our principal enemy here in Oregon is rain, and the rain is bad because it increases the amount of powdery mildew in Botrytis cinerea, that noble rot that's so celebrated in Germany, but if you get it growing on Pinot Noir grapes, you know, you have some big trouble. So that's always the danger, you know, to hang the fruit long enough for you to get the flavor development and also physiological development, the sort of botanic development that you're looking for. You just have to wait sometimes. And in 2010, it was one of those years we didn't have a lot of heat summation as measured in degree days. And that just means we had to hang the fruit out longer in order to get it to the ripeness levels that we desire. And especially since it began even later than normally, late flowering, late bud shoot development. But mercifully, it didn't rain on us until sort of just at the end. And so we did, you know, kind of get that hang time that we were looking for. And as a result, the wines are very elegant in their tannic structures. We did get some nice sort of red cherry spectrum fruit that year, not the gobs of heady blue-black fruit that we saw in 2000, but really, really just nice. Nice, supple, elegant. Some might say lean. I might call them pretty. Sort of tannins that sort of linger on the palate. So we just really lucked out in 2010. Mother Nature decided not to give us so much rain, and because we were hanging out so long. And then the 11 was like that, and again only later. So the thing with Oregon Pinot Noir is you just don't ever have the same vintage twice in a row.
It's interesting because the color of the wines. We drank three and we're cellaring three, and I'm going to ask you before we go how long we ought to hang on to them for. But the color was quite light. We've seen some Oregon Pinot Noirs where the color is really almost inky. So that's simply a characteristic of the fruit that particular year?
I think so. You can do things with, they have a huge host of wine products these days that would help to improve your color in any kind of wine, that even in a lean year like 2010, you could employ those and get to a darker color. But maybe like the Burgundies I love so much, I don't feel like I need to work on the color of a vintage. You know, I don't believe in those products, and I prefer to just take what nature gives me. And some of my most amazing Pinot Noir experiences have come from wines with almost no color at all. It's one thing that I just don't consider too much. I know other winemakers are interested in that. And then, of course, in other vintages, you just simply get a tremendous amount of color spilling out of the grapes because that's what the year gave you, the vintage gave you. So I think that you'll see a lot of color variation in our estate wines, and also across different vineyard sites. In fact, there'll be different hues that you get based on kind of the softness of the fruit and the extractability of it. It's one thing I suppose I could make them very dark every year, but where's the fun in that, you know?
Yeah, I didn't really know you could do that, but I suppose you can do just about anything with a wine these days, can't you? But maybe it's good you don't do that. The interesting thing is to have this rather light-colored wine coming out of this great, really hefty bottle that you put it in. It seems like what would come out of there should surely be much darker and thicker in viscosity. And it turns out it's not.
That's a great thing to say. I think there is a lot of times people drink with their eyes. You know, we talk about that as consumers, and you know, the packaging must sort of display all the care that's gone into the product and try to tell that story. You know, and so that's why for the like sort of larger bottle, but it doesn't weigh as much as some of those other larger bottles. We've been trying to work on the carbon footprint and not have it as heavy, but it is a large bottle. But you know, the thing that I like about Pinot Noir is that it is sometimes very, very powerful at the same time being very, very elegant. And I think that maybe that light colored wine coming from a big bottle maybe is a visual signal of that sort of balance and dichotomy that we have in Pinot Noir.
It's very interesting. I have some 99 Elk Cove left, only about two bottles left.
Oh, great.
Which I'm sort of saving. But that leads me to the next question, which is, you know, you made this wine in 2010. You can drink it right away, I know, because we enjoyed it, and I know you must be making it that way. How is it going to develop over the years? How long do you think before it will be really at its best?
Well, I think the first rule of thumb with Oregon Pinot Noir is that you'll be generally very, very well suited to give any Oregon Pinot Noir at least 5 years in the bottle from its vintage date. And even in the flabbiest, lowest acid years, which I think is really the key to the ageability of Pinot Noir, be pleasantly surprised with a five-year élevage in bottle. But then you have to kind of go to the qualities of the vintage after that. And so the 10s and 11s, like I said, had some similarities in that they had some pretty nice acid profiles, which acid structure kind of allows that primary fruit characteristic to hang on a lot longer. So if you still want to drink the wines and have it have vivacious fruit, I think, you know, you could go 7 to 10 years on a 2010 Oregon Pinot Noir, so long as, you know, the vintner respected the acid and liveliness of the wine, which they mostly did, because that's what we, that's the kind of vintage we have. But, you know, if you take a, let me get to that too. So at that 7 to 10 year mark, you'll see the fruit begin to fade, and you'll have those other sort of pay elements come up, the spiciness, and you know, maybe the light amount of French oak that we use sort of plays a more important role at that point, and you get some of those notes, and while the fruit fades, it will fade kind of gracefully and for years, and then it's kind of how long do you want to go after that. But I have certainly had some wines that from Oregon that were 20 plus years old that were really, really wonderful.
Wow.
And had not fallen apart, although I've had some that have.
So it sounds to me like it would be a very good idea if you had the opportunity to ask the winemaker or someone who knows the winemaker, what do you think about this particular year, and what do you think about this particular crop? Because that way you're not going to be disappointed. After all, I always think absolutely the worst thing is to hold a wine for a long time and then find out that you held it much too long, and it's on its way to vinegar.
We've had that.
Yeah, we've had that happen to us. Mostly the wines that people gave us.
Yes, exactly.
Because they didn't treat them with the proper kind of respect.
Yeah.
And I can assure you that the Elk Cove people will absolutely love the dark, deep corner of the basement wine cellar where the wine is, and yours is about 2 feet away from that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Then we're in good company. I really think that Elk Cove, especially the 99s, I just did an event with them, and they opened up Magnums going way, way back, but the 98 and 99s were the toast and the star of that tasting. And so we're in very good company there with that 98.
I think I have some
98 or 99 Elk Cove, rather.
I have some Roosevelt, and then they have one that's even higher in quality than that. And I think we might have drunk that one, but I'm hanging on to them and drinking them sort of like on every birthday, sharing them with a friend. And the friend just happens to be sitting right next to me right now.
And, it's what you want to have for dinner if you ever have the choice. I raid our library as well and try to really single out those 98 and 99 wines, because, you know, in their youth they had a lot of really kind of bright acid and big tannins that year, and kind of reminds one of the 2008 vintage that we just recently passed here in Oregon. And when you have those kind of vintages, they still keep their primary fruit for a very long time, and I think you're experiencing that as you're opening those up over time. So, you know, when you get to that higher end, you know, can go longer and still have wonderful fruit. But I would say that's 98, 99, 2002, and 2008 have those qualities for really long primary fruit characteristics. That 2010, while it's beautiful, very pretty, and has a lot of nice acid structure, will be kind of on the edge of a knife with regards to fruit at 7 and 10.
Well, it's interesting to get to talk to a winemaker and get all this really technical stuff.
Don, I think you should write a book. I like the way you talk about wine. I like your direct approach. I like your language. It's not that, you know, stupid stuff. You ought to write a book.
Well, I appreciate it, Dan. One day when I have time, perhaps. Thank you for that. I've got my hands full with the harvest coming on here in Oregon, and it's difficult to do that sort of thing. But I really appreciate your positive feedback.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and listeners, the website is WVV as in Willamette Valley Vineyards. Go there to find out more about how you can buy wines directly from the winery and perhaps where you can get them in distribution. And Don Crank, thank you so much for sharing part of our afternoon with us. And I'm tempted to open another 2010 for dinner tonight, but I'm not going to do that because I already decided.
Well,
I already decided
you've,
on
you've
its
done
future.
The right thing, which is you've drank some and then you've put some away. And so then you can kind of find the trajectory of the aging that you like the best. I just really appreciate this opportunity to talk with you and have our story get out to your listenership.
And tell Jim we hope he gets better real soon.
I hope he feels better than I do.
Yeah, I know. Thanks. Well, thanks for suffering through it with us, with your voice and everything. And that's really, you're quite the trooper. And I'll pass along your great thoughts to Jim Bruneau.
Thank you so much. And right after the break, we'll be back with another interview about American whiskey.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
I wonder why Peter gets to do all the introductions for the wine and the whiskey and the cognac and the tequila. It must be some typecasting going on here. But this is a fascinating story that we just came across quite by accident in the few days before we were heading to Euphoria, thanks to PR person who's doing a very good job for you, by the way, Andy.
Thank you.
And Andy Nelson, welcome to On the Menu Radio. We're delighted to have you join us today. And it's a fascinating story because you told me, as I was sampling a little bit of your wonderful beverage, that around the turn of the, not the century that just happened, the one before that, Nelson whiskey actually outsold Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey by 6-1.
That's right.
So what happened?
Well, first of all, yeah, thank you for having me. This is great. I really appreciate the opportunity. But if I also may correct you, it was more like 16-1.
16-1. Well, I am misremembering.
Yeah. So
that's a lot. That's a lot.
Right. And granted, of course, Jack Daniel's back then was not what it is today, but Charles Nelson was my great-great-great-grandfather. That's triple great. Ran Nelson's Greenbrier Distillery starting in the early 1860s, and he grew it into one of the largest distilleries in the country. Signature brand was called Nelson's Greenbrier Tennessee Whiskey, which was the sort of the original Tennessee whiskey. It was around before Jack Daniel's, and like you said, it outsold Jack nearly about 16-1 back in the day. Sort of the mid-1880s was sort of his peak of business and really his heyday back then.
Now, what happened along the way, aside from this thing called Prohibition, I guess? Did anything else happen along the way, or was that just the real killer?
Oh, that Prohibition was the one and only thing that really killed it, although there were certain sort of factors involved that Prohibition really made happen. What happened was, you know, if I may start from the very beginning and
please
tell
do,
the whole
yes.
story
please
real
do.
Quick. So from the very beginning, so Charles Nelson, like I said, my triple great grandfather, he was born in Germany in 1835. In fact, on the 4th of July, which I think is a pretty cool little detail there. And his father owned a soap and candle factory. So he decided that he wanted to move his family to America and sold the soap and candle factory, and this was 1850. So from the sales of the soap and candle factory, he took all the proceeds and basically had the family's earthly possessions converted to gold. And he had special clothing made to hold all of that gold on his purse, gold sewn into his clothing. From what I understand, that was not terribly uncommon back in the day. It's a lot safer than just having a single bag with all your possessions that someone could just steal. But anyway, so they got on a boat called the Helena Sloman from Hamburg to New York, October of 1850. And it was Charles and his wife. They had six children, but five of them came on the journey with them. Their oldest daughter had been married and moved to the U.S. already. So anyway, Charles's wife and five. Charles was the oldest son. His father was John Philip, who owned the soap and candle factory. So John Philip, his wife, and the five kids, Charles being the oldest. Okay, so they get on the boat, set sail for the United States. About the middle of the Atlantic, they encounter some severe storms and high winds, and the boat is damaged, and a number of passengers are thrown overboard, one of whom is the father. And so with all the gold on his person weighing him down,
he sank like a stone. Huh?
Right. So that was the end of that.
And so that's terrible.
Yeah, it is terrible, and it left the family penniless. So they get to New York quite literally with nothing but the clothes on. And Charles, being the oldest, at this point he was 15 years old, so he kind of became main of the family. So they get to New York, and Charles finds work at a soap and candle factory there. You know, it's all he knows how to do. Called the Hayes and Schultz firm, and he works there with his little brother for a couple. So then he moves the family up to Cincinnati, where his older sister had already moved. You know, there's a big German population there, and Charles becomes still is today, and he becomes a butcher there, and becomes friends with a number of other European German craftsmen, and learns a lot about the sales and production of alcohol. Whiskey. He gets married and has a son. And his wife dies shortly thereafter, and then he marries a second wife in Cincinnati before moving down to Nashville to open his own wholesale grocery business. So he gets to Nashville, opens his grocery business down on Market Street, which is now Second Avenue in downtown Nashville. Building is still standing and everything. And from there, his business was pretty much based on the foundation of his
his best three selling products, which are his coffee, his meats, and his whiskey. So he realized after a while that the whiskey was his best selling and most profitable product. And so he decided to say, okay, forget this grocery business. I'm going to go into the whiskey business. I'm going to buy the distillery that's producing the whiskey, and I'm going to let my other two guys, the butcher and the guy who delivers the coffee, I'll let them go do what they want with their respective products. So butcher was Mr. Hill, who went and started H.G. Hill Grocery Stores, which are still around in Nashville today, a family-owned business. The Hill family is a pretty well-respected name in Nashville. And then the guy who delivered his coffee was this kid named Joel Cheek, who went and brought that blend up to the Maxwell House Hotel a couple blocks down the street, and that ended up becoming a pretty well-known brand of coffee they call Maxwell House.
Oh, my goodness.
So Charles buys the distillery that produces the whiskey for his grocery. Distillery is about, in today's time, about a 30-minute drive north of Nashville. Back then, it was about a three-day ride. Buys the distillery. He buys a patent for improved distillation from a guy named Henry Kirk up in Greenbrier, and he expands the capacity. So by about 1885, Charles is selling about 380,000 gallons of whiskey a year. That's worldwide. I mean, we've got advertisements from Jacksonville, Florida, to San Francisco, all the way to Paris, France, and this is all, mind you, in the 1880s. So to be selling overseas before 1900 was a pretty big deal.
Kind of shows you the
scope of it.
Andy, let's move the clock forward a little bit, because this is a fascinating story, but it's not the real story of today, which is even more fascinating in a way. So something happened along the way called Prohibition, and that essentially put the Nelson Distillery out of business.
Right.
And did it revive at that time? Or, I mean, after the 21st Amendment, did it come back?
Not until today.
Okay. So this is the rest of the story that's so fascinating, because you and your brother found out about the history. It wasn't really something that was very well known in your family, even?
Right. I mean, my dad and some uncles and, you know, great uncles had... It had sort of been passed down through the generations, the story of it, but it, you know, each generation kind of lost a little bit of the detail. And so what happened was about 7 years ago, my brother and I and our parents were on a trip up to Greenbrier, Tennessee to buy a bunch. And so when we get to Greenbrier, what we had known growing up was we had heard a little bit about the story of Charles coming to America with father, with the falling off the boat with the gold and all this. And we knew that there was a distillery in Greenbrier. But that's about it. We didn't, you know, for all we knew, it could have been a big moonshine operation. We just didn't really know. At least Charlie and I didn't.
Why didn't somebody try to rescue the guy with the gold in his pockets?
Well,
you ask the stupidest questions.
I'm sure they tried. I go over that situation in my head all the time,
yeah,
figuring out how it might have happened. But
well, it's a good story. But okay, yeah. So what's next? Now you find the story. And
right, so we drive up to Greenbrier to buy a bunch of meat from this butcher. Our dad had gone in with some buddies to buy a full cow worth of meat. And so we were up there picking up our quarter of the cow. Since we knew that there was a distillery in Greenbrier, well, we stopped to get gas before we hit the butcher, and we see this historical marker right next to, in front of the gas station. It says Nelson's Greenbrier Distillery up on top. It says, 1 mile east on Long Branch Road, Charles Nelson built Nelson's Greenbrier Distillery, blah, 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 producer of fine whiskeys and fruit brandies, et cetera. And so we're like, wow, that's really cool. We didn't know it was quite such a big deal and such an official thing to have an historical mark. So we got our gas, went down the road, and just happens that the butcher lived about 1 mile east on Long Branch Road. And so we're like, okay, well, this is cool. So we asked the butcher what he knew about the distillery. And it turns out he lived on the land that the old distillery was on. He told us to look across the street. So we did, and we saw this old barrel warehouse standing, this old sort of rusted out building, grain house sitting above the creek, rushing underneath it, and then the old spring house, the original spring house with the spring still running, which was just incredible. We went across the street, looked at all these buildings, drank from the original spring, and of course it was the crispest, coolest, freshest, purest water you've never tasted, and we just fell in love with it from there, until the butcher even told us to head a couple blocks up the street to the Greenbrier Historical Society. So we went there, and we see, among other things, two original bottles of Nelson's Greenbrier Tennessee whiskey with our name on it.
No kidding.
Just just fell in love with it. And as cheesy as it sounds, we knew, you know, from that moment on that this is kind of what we're here to do. And like I said, that was about 7 years ago. So we've been working on it ever since then.
Now, when did you actually quit your day job?
I quit my day job about 2 years ago.
Okay.
Charlie quit his about 3.
Okay, that's your brother.
That's right.
Now the story is not quite complete yet, right? Because you have a whiskey to sell called Bell Mead,
uh-huh.
but that's just a stopgap measure.
In some ways, yes. Plan, you know, the original plan was, you know, raise a bunch of money, build out a distillery, and lay some whiskey down in barrels and wait for a few years for it to mature. But it turns out it's pretty tough for you know, 23 and 25 year old kids to raise few million bucks to start a business that they have no experience in. So what we had to do was figure out a way to get something going in the interim, you know, build some cash flow and show people that we know what we're doing and we can do it well. Basically, Charles Nelson back in the day had a portfolio of about 30 brands, one of which was called Bell Mead Bourbon. We were able to come across the original label to that, knew a little something about the recipe. And so what we've done now is started sourcing our whiskey, put together our own unique blend of different recipes to create sort of the best tasting high rye bourbon that we figure out. Because what we knew from it back then was that it was a high rye bourbon, and that's about all we knew. So we took the original label, tweaked it up a little bit, got it out on shelves.
Now, but the plan is to do something beyond that. The plan is to revive the distillery and make it Nelson's whiskey again?
That's right, yeah. So basically kind of get business up and running a little bit, sort of from dollar zero. Build up some revenues and generate some more cash flow and maybe some more investors. But we have our plans for our distillery actually in codes right now. We've submitted them so in the next few weeks we should be getting building permits. And what we're going to do is build out our whole distillery and start distilling the Nelson's Greenbrier Tennessee whiskey. In fact, we do have the original recipe for that. And that'll be, as it was back then, sort of our signature brand that'll really be, you know, the namesake of the distillery and
the
big thing that it was back then.
You need to know more than just the recipe if you're distilling spirits. How did you catch up on what you didn't know anything about before?
But you're talking about the production process itself?
Yeah.
How do you go about making that whiskey?
Yeah, well, so what we obviously knew was that there was a whole lot of history in this venture. And so the first couple of years were all research, whether it be historical research about our family and the history, or industry research and sort of research on production of spirits. And so what we did was we went around to any and everybody in the distilling industry that we could. We talked to experts, sort of asked them their advice and what they thought of it, and how to do it and how not to do it. And so we talked to people from all kinds of distilleries in Kentucky, folks here in Tennessee, and elsewhere, and came up with sort of a way to do it. Dave Pickerel, who's the former master distiller at Maker's Mark, what he does now is he runs a consulting company, and what he does is helps out little distilleries along the way, trying to, you know, show them how to do it basically from scratch. And so he's been very instrumental in helping us along. And what he does is he will be training, once we get our still up and running, he'll be training me to become the head distiller.
Right. Okay, so you're going to get hands on from a guy who used to make a pretty mean whiskey, and mean whiskey that's still being made. So how long are we going to have to wait? So we're going to have Bell Mead for the next 8 years,
and
then
and then
Nelson after that.
Uh huh. Yeah, the Greenbrier Tennessee whiskey is what our possible plans are to distill it and put it in barrels for 2 years to start out. Now, we might do the small barrel process where we'll put it in, say, half-size barrels and do that for 2 years, get a product on the market. Now, we'll do about a half and half where we'll put, for the first couple few years, we'll put half our whiskey in small barrels and half in standard-size barrels so that we can sort of phase out the small barrel production.
Got it.
And get it in the standard 53-gallon barrels. But what we're expecting is to, when we have the 53-gallon barrels, we expect probably a 5-year maturation for that.
Well, mark us down in your calendar. We don't look 5 years out for On the Menu, but I'm sure you do. You're obviously somebody who plans for the long haul.
You have to.
So when you're getting close, give us a call, send us a bottle, and we'll talk about it upon release. How about that?
Hey, I'd love that.
And thank you for a fascinating story of a little American history and a little German history along the way. Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you and your brother Charles every success in this venture.
Well, thank you guys very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sort of fits into the category of who knew, right? who knew my family used to make the world's best-selling American whiskey?
Oh, wow.
And then that disappeared from the face of the earth, and I rediscovered it all by accident and decided I would make it my life's work.
Well,
so I'm sure we'll be hearing from these Nelson boys again. And before we say goodbye to you for today, let's
Happy
just again wish you
New Year.
Happy New Year to you. We hope that all your troubles with little ones and all your blessings will flow upon you, and you'll win the Mega Millions if it hasn't already gone.
And eat black-eyed peas.
Of course.
And sauerkraut and pork.
And do all the other things. And don't forget the glass of Pinot Noir followed by a shot of bourbon.
Sounds like it'll be fun, or maybe
some of Joe's magnificent unblended American whiskey. And if you have a $4,000 bottle in your possession, shame on you. And we'll see you.
Shame on you for not sharing with us.
We'll see you once again on the first Sunday in the year of 2014. And until then,
bye-bye.